Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.
Point of View.
Legal matters.
So this is obviously the moment where everybody sits with their pens and are all waiting for the wise. The wise Ntabi Seng Dubazana, who comes in as a legal expert to give us all the necessary legal expertise for free, may I add. So if you want to take advantage of that, please call in on 086-00-00959, or you can also send a voice note on 063-688-0959. You can send a text as well if you want to remain anonymous. We don't mind that, but please do it as soon as possible so that you can get to your issues before we have to dash out of here. So, Ntabi Seng, good evening and welcome.
Good evening. Nice to be back.
Okay, so this terminology, footstewards, so commonly used.
Yep.
Whether you're buying a toaster from a second-hand, previously loved, that's how they call it these days, previously loved outlet, or you are buying an entire asset, you know, where I have seen offers to purchase, say, and just let me know if this is legal, where the person says, not that I know of. Especially property offers to purchase, where the person kind of thinks they can get away with saying, as far as I'm aware, the roof has got no leak.
Yeah.
As far as I'm aware, there is no structural issue. And it, the, as far as I'm aware, exonerates them from saying, I commit. So what does footstewart mean?
So footstewart basically means as is. You take it as is. You're not going to ask me any questions. You accept it as is. If anything comes as a result of you purchasing the previously loved item, if there's any problems that come with it, you will accept that it is what it is, and you will not hold me liable. That's the important part. You will not hold me liable for that particular defect. And most of the time, people don't care if it's small things like toasters and kettles and all of that.
From a pawn shop.
You know, but when it comes to things like homes and things like vehicles, then it becomes a bit of a problem.
Okay, let's talk about what's legal.
Yes.
Are you supposed to say to anybody buying anything from you that at the point when we say sold, I no longer take responsibility?
Not necessarily, no. These are called exemption clauses in your OTPs, ne? And those exemption clauses can be challenged. There is a misconception that just because the owner, the previous person who held ownership of this particular item, house, car, whatever the case may be, if they say that they put an exemption clause in there saying that this and this and this and this per what I think is the standard that's required, it's sufficient. No, you can challenge those things. There's numerous case law that goes wherein exemption clauses have been challenged and people challenge them successfully. So, for example, there has to be a certificate, the electric certificate.
Compliance.
Yes, to show that it complies. If that electric certificate is fraudulent, you can't say that as far as you know, because you're the one who had to make sure that that certificate is made available. You had to get the certificate, the home that it's in good standing and all of those things. It has to be in compliance with the NHBRC. All of those things have to be complied with. So you saying as far as you know is not sufficient. Because I am buying this house in good faith, that you are giving it to me in good faith, and we're entering into this contract in good faith.
Okay. You have seen it countless times.
Yes.
Where you go to an auction, everybody's excited, and he says, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, footstewards. You've seen it, right?
Yes.
And it's supposed to be, is that not legal? Can he not say footstool as is, going, gone? Is that not okay?
No. So there's a case. There's a case, yes, but there's also a Latin saying in law. It's called the pacta sunt servanda. pacta sunt servanda. It means the contract must be upheld. So even if there's a sale via auction, there's a contract you're still going to have to sign to transfer the ownership of the particular property.
Why is he saying it?
Because it's what they say. Just because it's what is happening doesn't mean it's the law. It's just what they say. I don't know why they say it, but they say it. So I... And then, so there's this case, and it was decided a few days ago, sometime, some 15th April, to be precise. So in this particular case, Pimelo sells and Tabising a car, a Mitsubishi car, and says it's a 2013 model. He does not say that I know for a fact, but as far as I know, which is exactly what we are talking about.
Oh, really? So is this the owner?
Yes.
Saying as far as I know.
As far as I know.
Haibu.
This is a 2013 Mitsubishi model car. And then Ntabisen pays $140,000, only to find that when the car was valued and assessed, it's a 2005
oh my word!
Model. And it's actually worth $80,000.
Yeah.
So Ntabiseng now takes Pimelo to court and says, no. You sold me something that is incorrect, so I want the difference. I don't want the $140,000. I just want the difference.
Okay, wait.
Yes.
Does it matter at which point this person discovered Hore Model A get 2005?
No.
Doesn't matter.
Because the contract still has to be obliged with. Because I took, remember the words I used were good faith. So there's always situations whereby if a contract is entered into mala fide, which is in bad faith, and we realize that this contract at a later stage,
much later,
a year or two down the line, that it was in bad faith, I can still go back to you say, this is what the contract was saying. I just discovered that this is the situation. The contract has to be abided with, right?
So, in the previous owner's defense,
yes.
Well, what is the defense?
So, the defense was, is as far as I know. I did not say that I certify that it is a 2013 model. All I said was, as far as I know, the car is 2013. So, in the lower court, he won.
Oh, wow.
Which was weird.
Wow.
Because in the lower court said, oh, well, it's your fault in Tabiseng.
Your responsibility to double
check. As the purchaser, that you didn't go and...
check the model.
Yes. And then when Tabiseng took it on appeal to the High Court said no.
The responsibility lies with the seller.
Yes, because he is the one putting a warranty in the contract saying it's a 2013 model. So he is bound by what he put in that contract to say this is what it is. It is not the obligation of the person who's receiving the item to go and confirm, because I am entering into this contract based on the T's and C's, which include that this particular model is a 2013 one, and therefore reversed the decision of the merge court. And then, because it was so bad that the merge court ordered a punitive cost order.
You?
Saying, how dare you bring such a frivolous case to me? And then the High Court is saying, no, magistrate, you don't understand the law. This person, which is now Pimelo, is the one who was supposed to adhere to his own contract. The contract must be adhered to at all times.
Okay, so what you'd pay, they would pay, were they ordered to pay the difference?
Yes, they were ordered to pay the difference, and then the costs of the appeal on a party to party. I feel like the judge was very lenient because party party is very cheap, considering that in the merge court a punitive cost order was ordered, which is, doesn't make sense.
I like this. I think it's important because I think the idea that, no, as far as I know, means that you, if you are the seller, you must do the work yourself.
Yes.
And of course, why didn't he think, as far as he knows, why didn't he charge less?
Yes.
As far as he knew.
Well, as far as he knew, he's alleging it's a 2013 model. Therefore, a 2013 model is worth $140,000. So therefore, he charged
it's
in
always
accordance
interesting
to what
how
he
these
knew.
People charge more.
Yes.
Why doesn't he assume it's older?
Yeah. Yeah.
As far as he knew.
And it was actually a second-hand car dealership.
Yes.
So
was it actually a dealership?
Yes, it was.
Not even a person.
Eastern Cape Motors. Yeah. It was Eastern Cape.
Well, I mean, beyond this, Ntabiseng, which I think is important, isn't there something else that could happen to a dealership that, because we don't know how many other cars they're doing this with. It's just that this particular purchaser went all the way to the courts.
Yeah, yeah. So it's likely that if this particular dealership, a lot of other people experience the same issues, they now have a basis to now refer all their cars that they bought from there to say that you have actually
let's check.
You sold me something that is not the true fact that you sold to me in the contract. And how many secondhand shops have we come across? How many shows are on our TVs that deal with people conning people with secondhand vehicles?
And would it have been feasible to say, I want all my money back, take your car back?
It would have been, yes. But in this particular instance, I think the person really just wanted the car. What you were saying is that it's not worth the 140. Mm. Give me the difference. But yes, it would have been that because you sold me. Remember, I think a few weeks ago, we dealt with more or less the same thing, but it was a brand new car. It was a Hyundai, I believe. Mm. And then he said, no, take your car and give me my money back because you said you're going to give me the bells and whistles per your advertisement. But what I got is not what was in there. And the court accepted that. And then the dealership was supposed to return the car and give him his money back.
Mm. Okay. We take your calls on 086-000-959. We take voice notes as well on 063-688-0959. And Ntabiseng Dubazana is here. She takes all legal questions. It really doesn't matter. We're just highlighting some of the cases that she's come through. But absolutely any case she'll be able to assist you with. If not, she'll be able to direct you to the right person with the right information. So you then have another one. It's I suppose it's the same. This one was a house.
It was with a house.
Yeah.
So, for example, in Joburg, how many townhouses are we seeing being built on a daily basis, mm-hmm. right? So,
on a flood line, may I tell you.
It is that bad. Mm. There's others that are being built on usufructs, mm-hmm. and you can't build on a usufruct.
Yes.
Where in the city of Joburg has outlined that you can't build here, but people build anyway.
Except that, and this is interesting because some of those developers, through obviously dubious means, get the city authorizing the building.
Mm.
And so they can produce a certificate, but except that nobody actually did the right thing.
Correct.
What then?
In this particular case, for example, it's what we call a latent defect. So let's say you are now building on a water line.
Yes.
And as a result of that, there's punctures.
Parts of Protea had that problem. Parts of Protea North, I think, where every year there's this water problem.
Yes.
And their homes are just experiencing the most because they're on a flood line.
Mm-hmm. So now there's a problem with every time there's probably water coming into the house as a result, or there is no water because there's being punctures and whatever on the pipeline as a result of the developer having done what they have done.
Yes.
So in this particular situation, the developer had left some timber or whatever it was in the chimney, which was a fire hazard. When the house caught fire in 2019.
What? What do you mean? So, did that happen? How did the timber get into the chimney?
So, it's discovered that, this person bought this house from Digwe Housing Development.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for 1.2 million. And then it was insured, obviously. And then in 2019, a fire broke out on the upper floor of the unit. The plaintiff's father lit a wood fire. Remember, there's a chimney.
Mm-hmm.
So the father lit the fire.
Like people who buy, a house with a, what else were you supposed
to do? It's
cold. It's supposed to be. It's supposed to be. That's exactly what it's supposed to be.
Exactly. And then,
so was this a normal fireplace? Was it not a gas fireplace?
No, it was a normal fireplace. Mm. It's a wood fire in the freestanding stove on the ground floor. The fire caused extensive damage.
Wait,
the property.
I'm still okay.
Yeah.
So in the chim inside,
yes,
there was wood.
Yes. The plaintiff alleged that the fire was caused by a latent defect, a timber roof truss that pass through the brick and mortar chimney, creating a fire hazard.
So what would it, what would have happened?
It should have been in terms of the NHBRC, which is basically the
body that deals with this. Building quality.
That timber should not be there. It should just be brick, or it should be whatever, coppers and whatnot, because it is a fire hazard.
So it was too close.
It shouldn't have been there.
Oh, my goodness.
It should not have been there. So when it was discovered by insurance.
This design.
Mm-hmm.
Aesthetic.
Yes.
Too
should
close.
Not have been there.
The fireplace is too close to the... to the aesthetically beautiful timber.
Yeah.
Haibo.
Which should never have been there in the first place.
So this timber caught fire.
Yes. As the sparks and whatnot are going from the chimney.
Hey, Corina. The question I have is, I mean, I suppose, I don't know, if I saw a design of a house like that, I'm just wondering whether I would have picked up on, interesting how the fireplace is sitting next to a wood timber design.
Yeah.
So was the owner meant to pick that up?
The developer or the person buying?
The one who's buying.
From the way it's described, it was in the chimney. So it wasn't like a structure on the outside. So it was like a piece of wood going from one wall of the chimney to another.
So maybe part of a ceiling.
Yes. So they would not have been aware in the first place that the timber is there.
Yeah. Chimney. Maybe. So maybe above the ceiling.
Yes.
So it's not, it's covered.
Correct.
In other words.
That's the way it sounds like it was described. So as the fire is going,
beyond the ceiling,
yes.
Things are happening.
Yes. And then the timber catches fire.
Hey, Matan. And so what was the quote?
So now, the matter now goes to court. In fact, insurance, like the house was insured.
Yes.
Insurance comes and investigates and says, nah, man, cause of fire,
This was never supposed to be there.
And then obviously they pay out for the guy because really it's not his fault. It was a defect that came with the house. And then he then sues
the developer
to say, I've not only have I lost my home, but now I've also lost all these things, all the other movables.
Inconvenience.
And then the developer is saying, there's an exclusion cost clause.
And what would it have been?
It said that you will buy it as is. So it's not my fault that it caught fire. That's basically the defense that the developer put in. They did not bring any expert evidence to show that the way in which that they built the property could have caused any fire. The buyer, the owner of the property, brought in expert witnesses and people from the NHBRC to say it was non-compliant in the first place. Mm. So you saying there's an exemption clause is irrelevant. Mm. You still had to answer to us to say that this property is NHBRC approved, which didn't happen because we would have told you that this should not be in here. And before you sell it, fix it or move it. And as a result, the court found in favor of the purchaser or the buyer in the property to say, you are liable. You ought to have known better. You're the developer. And if you didn't know, you ought to have known because you're the one who built it. The plans were with you. You knew what needs to be done when you build a property as a developer. You knew what the requirements for the NHBRC are. And the court just went through all the expert witnesses and what they gave and what the NHBRC said. And then he couldn't do anything about it. He couldn't prove anything or counter anything that came from the purchaser. So as a result, that's what it is. They were now liable to pay for the property. And I'm saying this because I know a lot of people are buying from these new developments. And some developments are put, for example, one on a mudslide.
So explain where the funder comes in. Generally, the bank, which is the funder, sometimes comes in, especially if it's finance property, to assess whether this property is worth this money you're applying for. How are they exempt?
So I think in this particular matter, the person purchased the property in cash. So when it comes to that situation, they would be either the first or second respondent. The first respondent would be the developer.
Mm.
Second respondent would be the bank. Would say, how did you miss it?
How did you approve
in the assessment of the property?
Yes.
How? And then they would then have to also pay out whatever portion would be due to them, because some, you know, if a house is worth 1.2 million, you're going to end up paying like 2.5 or 3 million in return to the bank. So the damages, the costs, the insurance that comes from the bank would then have to be refunded to the purchaser.
But if this was a financed property, the bank would also have to be liable.
Yes.
For approving this development.
Yeah, and likely they probably would request to be also joined in. If they were not joined in by mistake, they would have to request to be joined in to say, my client, which is Ntabise, the purchaser, is refusing to pay because the property was not dealt with in accordance and I did not know what is happening, and then they want to claim whatever monies they would have paid to this person for the property. So it would either be as a co-applicant or most likely a respondent in the matter, because you ought to have known. You were assessing the property before you gave me the bond or the loan. So how did you miss it?
Okay.
Yeah.
I have an ex. Is it? Do we call it an ex?
I think so.
Salamina here on X is asking about what recourse she has. So basically, the story goes that my child has been at a private school for the past 8 years, but in the last 2 years, I've struggled financially and I'm owing the fees. My son is now in matric. We're at a stage where the school wants to expel my child. It is rather late in the year, in his matric year, and I have nowhere to take the school. Is the school in their rights to send my child out of the school?
Unfortunately, yes, because the contract is between you and the school, not between you and not between the school and the scholar. With that being said, have you attempted to enter into an agreement? Because I know there's a case, I can't just remember when it was decided, but there's a case that is similar to yours, wherein the school, when the matter was taken to court, or the Department of Education, I think it was, either one, wherein it was said that the child is close to matriculating, allow him to finish of his studies, and then should the parent still fail, you have a recourse to take this person to court and whatnot to recover your monies. But let Section 28 be paramount in this situation. Section 28 of the Constitution, which is the children's rights and children's right to education. So if the negotiations are failing, wherein let's say the school fees is, I don't know, 20,000 rand per month, and you can only afford an amount of 5,000, there's something that's coming. It's not like they're not receiving anything at all. Let that be part of the arrangement. And if they are not willing to do so, I would say go see an attorney. But if you can't afford school fees,
you won't afford
it. Yeah.
You must take that money to school.
Yeah, no, take that money to school, but try and negotiate. But yes, to answer you, the school is well within their rights to say they are terminating, because the contract stipulates you're supposed to pay X amount by this particular time of the year or of the month, and you're failing to do so.
All right, Sarah is asking again on X. I am owing the municipality quite a substantial amount of money. I've been unemployed for the past 4 months. And the municipality has threatened to switch off my water. Is water not a human right? And are they right to be switching off my water?
Such a complicated one, that one. Yes, water is a basic human right. With that being said, you are paying rates and taxes. You entered into an agreement with the city or the municipality, and as a result you are failing at paying. So one, like I said with the previous one, enter into an agreement, a pay as you go or whatever the case may be, because I've got a sneaky suspicion that she did not tell them that she's unemployed, because they actually have different databases for people who are not employed, people who are pensioners, child-headed, all of those things. So they know how to bill you. But also in the area that you live, there's also things that you would have to look at. If you're living in an affluent area, mm-hmm. then, you know, the payments are kind of different versus you living in Kasi or in a not a non-affluent area. So firstly, tell them you're not employed. To then enter into an agreement on how you're going to pay that. Because as long as you're paying, then they won't switch off. But if you're not doing anything at all, they will likely come and switch it off.
If I stand to be corrected, Ntabi Singh, I think they're supposed to throttle the water.
Yes, not completely switch it off.
Not completely switch it off.
Same thing with electricity.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
How do you throttle electricity?
We tima mutsiari, you bring it back in the evening. I had a case.
Really?
Yeah, I had a case like that a few years ago. They would come and switch it off during the day and then hire a man, see where they switch it on.
Really?
Yeah, that's what they did.
That is interesting.
It was very interesting.
Would electricity be a basic human right?
It's become a basic human right, yes.
So when they just totally switch you off, what recourse does this person have, does Sarah have?
They can take them to the Human Rights Commission, to any court to say, switch me back on because you're depriving me of my basic human rights.
Because I think there are a number of liters you're entitled to.
Yes.
Every household is entitled.
Yes.
I don't know what the liters are.
I think they've reduced or increased them in the like recently. There was like circulations in different municipalities to say there's no longer free 60 liters or something like that. It's now sitting at 40, something along those lines. But there is an amount that is you're entitled to that is free. So
this person can, at least if they can't pay, they are entitled to some water.
Yes, they are.
By the municipality.
But when that limit AO that we're talking about that says you're entitled to X amount of free water has depleted, then you might be facing a bit of a problem, because you would have been able to use water from morning to night, but now they're limiting it to say you can only use it during the day between these hours because you're in debt. So pay something, go to the municipality, tell them that you're not working, pay 500 rand. That's how reasonable they are.
Are they entitled to attach your property?
Yes. They can issue a letter of demand, which I'm sure they have. And if you fail to do so, they can get their lawyers to issue summons. And with that, they can come and attach whatever movable property that is in your house. And if it's not sufficient to satisfy the debt, then they make an application to the court to attach the house. But they have to start with the movables first before they go to the immovables.
Does this apply to a property that's still owing to the bank?
Yeah.
How does that work? Because then it's not your property, it belongs to the bank.
So what they do is that they cite the bank as a second respondent in this matter. And then they say that, well, with this property, this person is where they are. And then the bank may choose to defend it or want to claim whatever that they can claim in the outstanding amount. But yeah, usually they attach it anyway. They make an application and they have to convince the court at least that they have a right to sell the property.
So they would say, we want X amount from the property.
Yes.
Yes, the property may cost, I don't know, however million or whatever, but we're going to sell it anyway. We'll give the bank the balance.
Yes.
But we will take
what is ours.
What we need to take.
Yeah.
Can they defend that?
They can. They can do it, because usually it is rendering the caller, the writer, is rendering them insolvent. So it's a Section 9, Section 10, and Section 8 of the Insolvency Act application to render this person insolvent, that they have failed. They've done an act of insolvency by failing to pay whatever is due to them. And I've seen people be declared insolvent, get it 12,000 rand. So if you don't respond to these things and you just let them go because it's the municipality or it's the body corporate, whatever the case may be, you will find yourself being insolvent. And when you're declared insolvent, it takes 10 years for you to clear all of that.
Okay. I'm not. So can you stop the process of being insolvent even though you are owing so much?
Yes. So what happens is that you, the applicant, the person who's owed, in this case the city, is going to make an application for a rule nisi.
Mm-hmm.
So a rule nisi is like an interim order that says that Ntabiseng has declared or has done an act of insolvency by failing to pay.
Mm-hmm.
We have sent the summons, we have a default judgment, we have attached certain things, and yet it's still not satisfied. She hasn't even attempted to pay anything. So we want the court to declare Ntabiseng provisionally insolvent for about 90 days. And then thereafter, if nothing still has happened, then we're going to come back to the court and then confirm the rule nisi, which is basically making you permanently now, you are insolvent. And then they hand over your estate to the master. And then the master now sends advertisement to all your creditors, not just this particular person.
Mm.
So this now includes the banks, I don't know, the rates and taxes people, whoever, everybody who is your creditor can now come and pick. Because once you're declared insolvent, they sell everything.
I got you.
To try and satisfy all debts. And then all creditors come and pick from your estate. And then thereafter, that's that, it's over. So if they sell that particular property, the property is worth 3 million, and maybe you were left with, I don't know, 1 million on the bond, the bank is going to be the first one, I assume, to come and see that the property is not sold for less than the amount that is owed to them. And then from, I don't know, your rates and taxes, you owe this much, and then your water, you're at 500,000 for argument's sake, or even 40,000. Then they pick like that, and then your estate is left empty.
Hmm. Something close to the issue from Buti. I'll come back to Buti. Let me, who's on X, asking about a property that the bank sold for less than the value or what they're owing, because they were owing the bank.
Yeah.
So it went to auction, and they are asking if they're within their rights to contest the money it was sold for.
Well, the contesting the amount that it was sold for, not necessarily.
I think it was too little.
Yeah, but usually you are not in control. So I wish I knew if there was a rule nisi that was made and then it was confirmed. Because after that, the master can do whatever with the property. You have no say. Mm. So what ought to have happened if it was just a situation of they made an application for the immovable property to be sold or whatever property to be sold without you being declared insolvent. You could have made an application for the stay of execution, which is staying the auction and all of that, because maybe, like he's saying, that the amount was too little or whatever. But you won't know until the auction has happened that this house was sold
happened. So this person is owing the bank for the house.
Yeah.
So this is someone who the bank is trying to recover their money through an auction for the house they're owing. Their argument is that they're owing the value of the house compared to what the bank was willing to sell the house for was unfair, because they want to recover the money, but it didn't seem like they were recovering the money in good faith. In other words, they were selling it off for very cheap, leaving this person, this booty, with a big debt.
Okay, in that situation, I think what would have been the proper thing to do was, because the master, the bank ought to be in communication with Buti to say this is what's currently happening, even though they have an order in their favor to auction off the property.
Yes.
There was a case whereby this guy sold a house for 1,000 rand.
Yes. I don't know the numbers, but yeah. I think it's similar to that.
Yes. Well, and then the court went back and said that's ridiculous.
Sometimes is it not one rand? They said one.
Yes.
Rand.
Yes. But that one was sold by 1,000 rand.
Mm.
And then the court said, oh, that's ridiculous. That doesn't make any sense. So it was sent back for it to be sold properly. So yes, you can challenge it. But if your property has been sold, are you going to be able to take it to court to challenge the manner in which the auction was conducted? That's the thing. But yes, you have grounds to challenge.
Okay. You do have grounds, Buti, if you want to go ahead and do that. Here's another one. Ntabi saying, how many times or how long can an employment contract be extended? Ha, interesting one. If initial contract was for 3 months and the position is still available and they want to extend it for another 2 months. This happens a lot with municipal workers.
Mm.
For years, eh? Not just... It's three months. People are in jobs for 10 years with these little 3 months contracts.
The Employment Equity Act has tried to curtail that. I can't remember the exact section, but it has tried to say a contract can only be renewed so many times.
Yeah.
And as a result, when that happens, you have a right to say, I've proven myself. Because... let's say you are going to apply for a permanent position. Your probation sometimes is 3 ranging to 6 months sometimes. You've proven yourself for 2 years that you can do the job. Why are you not being offered? The employer is obliged to give an explanation as to why it is they're not giving you the permanent post. And if their reasons fall within the discrimination category, then they have no right to do so. They must put you in that post. So... yeah,
we don't know how long, ne?
Yeah, we don't know how long. I will double check and find out how long.
Yeah, this has been an issue with many municipal workers.
Yes,
who especially menial jobs where the person is a cleaner and they just keep getting renewed, running away obviously from the costs, the
for
cost
permanent
cost
employment.
To company.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And so. Would the company be within their rights to say, I cannot afford the cost to company of this individual? This is why I keep giving them an extension on a contract.
Then you should then entrench as the company. You should entrench Section 189. Section 189 is not strictly for retrenchment.
Okay.
It's for other issues wherein there's things that the employer cannot control as a result of the work environment, financial situations, to see, can I deploy you elsewhere? Because if I put you in a permanent post in this particular situation, I will not have the funds to continue for the next 6 months. But if I put you in position A instead of position B that you are currently looking for, I can put you on a permanent contract there. Let's look at that. So let these discussions happen. Section 189 is very broad, and these are the things that can be dealt with.
Would Section 189 be something they can use to say, same position, we're not asking you to change your position, except that we are saying, maybe we no longer need you as a full-time employee. We are now adjusting your contract to this contract situation. Will that sort of be the section to use?
If the person was a permanent person, but if it's always been contract, no.
If the person was a permanent person, can you adjust that?
Yes, you can adjust that. You can. By negotiations. It's not a unilateral thing. It has to be by agreement between the parties. But what you see is that employers tend to do that by a decision on their own to say, we've decided we can't afford you and this is what we're doing.
I heard someone was telling me that they were not saying we've decided. They said they gave them a choice, except the choice was to accept it or leave.
Which is not how it's supposed to be. It has to be a consultation. It has to be a discussion. Let it be a situation, Yahori, we've been discussing for 3 months, 4 months, you know. It can't be a year because that's ridiculous. Because the company's already told you we are struggling in one form or another. So give it some leeway between 2 months, 3 months. Discuss the situation. And if you guys can't agree on how to come to a compromise, then the company will be in a position to say, we have tried. So as a result, we are now going to give you the normal retrenchment package, which includes X, Y, and Z. And then that's that. Then it's up to you whether you're going to take it to the CCMA for dismissal by way of retrenchment. But then if those discussions have happened, the employer has a better case than yours at the CCMA without you. If you did not come to the party, in other words, you were just standing on a hill and you intended to die on it without coming to reach to a compromise, you will not have a good case when you go to the CCMA.
All right. This you've dealt with before, but we'll go anyway. Elebo is asking on X, I can no longer pay maintenance because I've since been unemployed. Mm. What do I do to make sure that I still have my visitation rights?
Okay, maintenance and visitation, two different things.
Yeah.
It can never be that you're not allowed to see your child because you're not paying maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
So if mom is denying you access, go to the children's court to get your your access, continue with that. With maintenance, please run to the maintenance court immediately. Go and tell the maintenance officer, I have not been employed for X amount of days, months, years, whatever. I cannot afford maintenance. So they stop it, because if she goes to the maintenance court and holds you in contempt of court, it's a problem. So run to the maintenance court, tell them you can't afford, they will stop the order. And then once you are employed, continue from where you left off, because it's only being stayed. It's not being terminated. It's being stayed until the moment you're able to get a job. But the two are not related.
All right. Edwin is in the West Rand. Hello, Edwin. Good evening.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, you know, there's a situation where I'm employed. You know, there was this called added education that 2015, we migrated to what we call Community Education and Training College. And then since then, there are principals who have been acting in position for more than 10 years.
Mm.
Yes.
So what's your question, Edwin?
I'm sorry, what does the law say? Because these people, they've been renewing their contract. Actually, somebody's acting for more than 5-10 years.
In the position.
In the position. They are called what we call acting center managers.
Mm.
Actually, the term is principal. It's just in center manager, but it's the same as principal.
Acting for 10 years in the position.
So have they taken it up with the department or the employer to ascertain why it is they're still acting?
It has been like that. I don't know what they're doing, because recently the portfolio committee, they actually said no. Why is the department not
appointing
people on a temporary basis? That was said by a chairperson in the portfolio committee. In educating the
AGT
committee.
Mm. So I was going to ask that now, how has it been dealt with internally? So if it's already with the portfolio committee, wherein they're discussing the permanent position of these particular individuals, let's wait for the outcome. Sorry?
Something that is interesting, like we have this group of center managers that was posted by the portfolio chairperson to say, why is it not that they're employing these people?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the answer was?
No, well, the department is quiet, actually. And
okay.
I think maybe, why are these principal not taking the matter up?
Okay. So I would suggest that with that request from the portfolio committee, inquiring as to why it is that the principals are not being appointed permanently, you can take that to the bargaining council and use it as unfair labor practice, because there's no reasons that have been furnished by the department as to why it is these principals have been acting for 10 years. And then that way it will force them to act. I remember, because we had to deal with something similar in a different department. I think it was health or something like that. And then people were temporary drivers going to these different hospitals and whatnot, and the contracts were now going on 8 years, and we then took it to the bargaining council, and then the contracts were then converted to a permanent post, because now lawyers were now involved. So let them take it to the bargaining council under the umbrella of unfair labor practice, because there's no reason why they should not be put as permanent employees, using that portfolio committee's resolution or questions that were asked.
Yeah, actually, and they belong to UNONSTAR, to NEHAU, NAPTOSA, you know, those.
Let them try and assist them to go to the bargaining council, and because those unions ought to know that this is what is supposed to happen. But if they don't have lawyers who are actually well versed in labor law, sometimes they won't know that it is unfair labor practice.
Thank you very much.
All right. Here is another one. It says, Dumelang Hle Thusang, I have defaulted for 2 months already, but the property is being sold. Attorneys are changing papers, but the bank is calling me every day, even though I have informed them and gave 90 days notice. Are they not abusing me by calling every day? Mentabiseng batong.
Here's the thing about banks. The departments don't speak to each other. So call center agent doesn't know what's happening.
Okay.
So usually you'll be called by Ntabiseng today, tomorrow you'll be called by Mudibedi, so on and so forth. So they don't know that there's a legal process. They're just doing their job. So what you can do, you're saying that attorneys are exchanging papers. It sounds like you have an attorney as well. Why don't you guys enter into a settlement agreement already? I mean, it's now forced upon everybody now in terms
but
of Rule 41.
But that's what it seems like. I have informed them and gave 90 days notice.
To notice to do what? To you see, that's the part we don't know.
I get it.
So is it the notice to say you will be selling
possibly,
the property?
Possibly an easy sale type thing.
Yeah. So if there's no settlement, if that's what the case is, and there's exchange of those documents, great. Then you should be fine, because like remember the Rule 41 thing. It's now mandatory where mediation has to happen. It doesn't matter anyway. So before the bank sets this matter down, they have to prove to the court that mediation had happened between the parties. This would form part of mediation, to say there's an agreement or there was an attempt to agree to pay 500 rand per month towards the 1,000 rand that I owe you or whatever, and you know it failed because of X, Y, and Z. So at this stage, if that 90-day notice was to say that I will be able to pay by the end of the 90 days, that's going to form part of the mediation or Rule 421 request that is made by the judge president. So, yeah, try and negotiate with them. But with the calling, unfortunately, even if you were to send it to the particular call agent who called you today, tomorrow is going to be another one who then goes onto the system and says, oh yeah, I see, it's here, sorry ma'am, tomorrow's another one. So the calling, they don't talk to each other, those departments. It's different departments, unfortunately.
So we, you know, there's nothing to do that can be done about the abuse and the harassment.
No,
that's a different thing completely.
Yeah,
the 2 months though, is that reasonable?
They do it even go 1 month.
Oh,
your first default, they can run to the courts and say you have failed to pay. So what they would do is that they would send you an SMS, an email to say you are defaulting or you have defaulted. Please pay the full amount by 7 days or whatever. And then if that 7 days passes and nothing happens, they issue summons. They don't waste time.
It's yeah, that's very sad.
Yes,
because that
extremely.
Means that I mean, I always thought that there was some sort of a grace period.
No, there ought to be, as in terms of the National Credit Act. I think it's Section 147. I think it's Section 147. There should be a situation where they send you a notice. That notice is supposed to be a 30-day notice,
mm-hmm.
that you should fix something. But the banks, for whatever reason,
How come the laws that govern evacuation laws, that govern how you cannot evacuate somebody unless you have alternative accommodation, does not apply with banks in this regard?
The National Credit Act and the eviction, two different things, because here we're only dealing with it. We're not kicking you out of the property.
Okay.
We are saying we're recovering money that are due to us. And we're making an application to the court to say, we've tried to attach certain things to get our money back. We're not succeeding. Therefore, the only other option is to get back our asset that is still actually ours, which, you know, we are allowing Ntabiseng to reside in. Yes, you can counter that by using the PI Act, Prevention of Illegal Eviction Act, to say that you are kicking me out, but I have nowhere else to go. You know, can we rather enter into a negotiation, into an agreement, and all of that? It doesn't always work. The court is always on some, okay, you are getting the benefit of being in a home, being protected, being all of this, but they are still losing money. And you entered into a contract. Remember the case we were talking about, that the contract always has to be adhered to. Unfortunately, she has to, or the buyer or the purchaser has to always adhere to their part of the contract.
Okay. I've got a call here. Okay, no, we're going to, because it's rather late. And tell me, where do people find you?
People can find us at 37 Harley Street in Ferndale, Randburg. Alternatively, they can call us on 087-265-8010 or send us a WhatsApp on 079-654-7523 or send us an email on info@dubazanaattorneys.co.za.
All right, folks. We are still back tomorrow. I know it's a public holiday, but we'll be back tomorrow at 8.
Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.